All right, we are live with Alexander Mercuris in London, and we are very honored to have with us Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Professor Sachs, thank you for joining us on the Duran.
I have great to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. I have your information where you can follow Professor Sachs in the description box down below, and I will also add it as a pinned comment when the live stream is over. So definitely follow Professor Sachs and everything that he is writing about with regards to what is happening in the world. And we have a lot going on. So a quick hello to everyone that is watching us on all of the platforms. And thank you to our moderators in the chat. Thank you for keeping everything running. Alexander, Professor Sachs, let's talk about what is happening in the world.
Let us indeed. And who better to discuss this, all of this whole situation, than Professor Sachs. Professor Sachs, who understands international relations, who knows the region very well, who can talk to us about the economic consequences of this war for the region and for the world. Professor Sachs, let's begin straight with what is, in some ways, I think, the single most important thing. President Trump talks about this being in some ways a war for necessity. He speaks about this being a war that must be fought. I find this extraordinarily difficult to understand. We had negotiations ongoing. The negotiations seem to be succeeding. The Omani mediators were happy. The Iranians were making concessions. What is the moral legal foundation for this war? Is the one? And if there is no such foundation, what conclusion can we draw?
Well, good morning to both of you and everybody. This is the ultimate war of choice, the ultimate war that never should be, never had to be. This is the war of Bibi's choice, decided 40 years ago in Bibi's fervid imagination. But also, this is a U.S. Deep state war as well, with everything amplified by a mentally unstable president, to just put it bluntly. What do I mean by this? Well, first of all, there was no cause of war. Iran was not threatening the United States or Israel. In fact, it was virtually begging for negotiations over the past 2 years, even after the first time of negotiations last June was interrupted by a U.S.-Israeli war. So the Iranians wanted negotiations rather fervidly. And I met twice in the past 2 years with President Pezeshkian when he came to the United Nations. His entire remarks on both occasions were about peace, the desire for peace, the absolute insistence that under religious doctrine, under the fatwa of the late supreme leader, the one assassinated by Israel, they did not want nuclear weapons. They had already signed off against nuclear weapons. They just did not want to be attacked and overthrown the way that Israel and the United States are attempting today. So basically, this is not a war that came because of any exigency, any pressing matters, certainly not in any conceivable way a war that is legal under the UN Charter. Article 51 allows for the use of force in the event of self-defense of an armed attack. Of course, there was nothing remotely like that in the context of the Israeli-U.S. attack here. So what is going on? Well, the first point to emphasize is that the United States and Israel never wanted a negotiated outcome with Iran, not last year, not this year, and not during the past decade. How do we know that? Because they had one when President Obama negotiated the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, in 2015, an agreement between Iran and the P5 members of the Security Council, the U.S., U.K., France, China, Russia, plus Germany, so the P5 plus one, and then ratified immediately, unanimously by the UN Security Council, there was an agreement for Iran to be under strict UN supervision, the International Atomic Energy Agency, to make sure that what Iran was saying and what it was saying repeatedly for decades, that it did not want a nuclear weapon, that its energy program was not for a nuclear weapon, was in fact the case. Now, important to know, under the JCPOA, Iran was in strict compliance. There was absolutely no sense in which what happened in 2018 was because of Iranian actions. What happened in 2018 is Donald Trump tore up the JCPOA. He said, we're not going to be party to it. We're not going to be party to an agreement not only duly reached and being implemented, but one that was unanimously adopted by the United Nations Security Council. Why did he tear it up? Well, his buddy Bibi Netanyahu told him to. Netanyahu since then have been in active delusion that they would simply overthrow the Iranian government, never wanting to negotiate. I had a very strange, unpleasant interaction with one of the U.S. negotiators last year when I thought I could be a little bit helpful to make a suggestion or two, because I thought there were actual negotiations going on, and I was extraordinarily rudely brushed off, and that was the last time I tried to make any informal suggestion about how to move forward. And it was clear to me from then something so weird is going on, because this was before the bombing last June, but it was absolutely clear how completely strange things were. There was no attempt at negotiation. Now, all of this became clear. I had to make one correction to what I've been saying. I've been saying for years that Iran is being targeted by Israel for 30 years. And I emphasize 30 years because 30 years ago, a political doctrine of Netanyahu and his American political advisors called Clean Break was issued as Netanyahu became prime minister of Israel. So I said this is a 30-year attempt to overthrow Iran. I stand corrected because Netanyahu himself has made clear that even for 10 years before that, when he wasn't prime minister, it was also his dream. He's actually posted that this war is a 40-year dream. So that means it's not exactly driven by the events at the negotiating table, whether Iran was negotiating in good faith, whether what was happening with the Omani mediator was working. And of course, we also have to appreciate that the Omani mediator said extremely clearly the negotiations are proceeding. They were essentially a fake, a cover for a 40-year dream. Now, having said that, let me put this in context. I'll start 30 years ago with Clean Break. Clean Break is the prevailing doctrine of the Israeli right wing, which runs the country with a lot of broad support, I should say. So it's not the case in the United States that Netanyahu doesn't have support for his violence. It's more widespread in Israel. Clean Break was the doctrine that said there would never be a state of Palestine. and that the way to ensure that there would never be a state of Palestine in the two-state solution would be not to resist the militants such as Hamas that were fighting for a Palestinian state, but rather to take down every government in the Middle East, and I should add, in Africa, that supported the Palestinian cause. And this actually built on earlier Israeli doctrines, extreme militaristic doctrines called the periphery doctrine, which is side with the countries in Africa or the Middle East that are non-Islamic if they can find them. So Christian countries or places with some Christian populations to fight the Islamic majority states, and especially those that support Palestine. So the foreign policy of Israel has been a policy to overthrow governments in the Middle East that support the Palestinian cause, with the ultimate objective being greater Israel. Greater Israel is an ideological doctrine of right-wing Zionism, which says that Israel controls all of the land of what was once Palestine under the British mandate. But for many of these zealots, especially the biblical literalists in Jewish Zionism and in Christian Zionism, much bigger, in fact, than mandatory Palestine, but as the U.S. Ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, said a couple of weeks ago, in his interpretation of Genesis 15, Israel's rights extend from the great river of Egypt to the great river of Mesopotamia, the Euphrates. Okay, this is all mind-boggling, but let me come back to the main point. The main point is that since 1996, it has been Netanyahu's political doctrine to overthrow governments across the region that support the Palestinian cause. That's amazingly what this is about from Israel's point of view. The reason that the U.S. goes along with this has many potential threads and explanations. We can come back to that. Of course, part of it is the Zionist lobby in the United States, no doubt. Part of it may be blackmail under the Epstein files and that kind of thing. But part of it also is a U.S. doctrine of global hegemony that fits well together with the Israeli doctrine of regional hegemony. So it's not simply Israel telling the U.S. what to do, but the U.S. neocons, who are tightly linked, of course, with the right-wing Zionists, have a global doctrine in which Israel's clean break doctrine fits well, that Israel will be the agent or the partner in ensuring hegemony in the Middle East as part of a U.S. absolute doctrine to have global hegemony. Okay, so we're in something that's very long term. It has a couple peculiar features to it. One is that both the leader of the United States and of Israel are old, very sick men. They are mentally deranged. That's not a political judgment I'm making. It's my best guess, listening to lots of psychologists and psychiatrists about the actual state of affairs. They are both megalomaniacs. And again, not in a kind of a political cartoon sense, but I think in an actual clinical sense. They are extreme narcissists and My view is that they're psychopaths, which is also a clinical condition, meaning a lack of remorse or sympathy for victims. And Trump seems to display this in a massive extent. So you have an underlying political doctrine in two countries, U.S. global hegemony, Israeli regional hegemony for the sake of greater Israel. You have two leaders who are old, corrupt, unhinged. And this, to my mind, is the basic reason that we have this dreadful, dangerous, disastrous war underway. One final point, if I may say it, and then back to you. The clean break doctrine has been implemented by Israel and the United States for 30 years. So this is not a hypothetical. This is the actual implementation. And General Wesley Clark, who was the NATO Supreme Commander under Bill Clinton, told us after 9/11 about the application of this doctrine when he visited the Pentagon soon after 9/11. That's back in 2001. He was shown a document that said that the United States would engage in seven wars in 5 years. The idea was to remake the Middle East. This was, in effect, the post 9/11 application of clean break. The seven wars were Libya, Sudan, Somalia, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Iran. We've had all seven wars now. It wasn't 5 years. We know from inside testimony that they chose as the first of those seven in West Asia the attack on Iraq in March 2003. They expected that to be a walkover, and then they would continue on with the rest of the wars. But that one proved not to be a walkover. The U.S. got bogged down in the local civil war and violence for many years. And so they didn't reach Iran soon afterwards as they expected. But the fact of the matter is that all of the wars have now taken place. Libya was overthrown by a brazen regime change operation in 2011. Sudan was destroyed by a heavily Mossad-led and supported insurrection by South Sudan that broke Sudan in two. Now we have two civil wars, one in Sudan and one in South Sudan. Of course, Lebanon is in active destruction and Israel is invading again as we speak. Syria, the overthrow attempt began in 2011. Notice that Obama, our nice president, was leading the Libya and the Syrian wars. This is across all these presidencies. It doesn't really matter exactly who's president. But the Syrian overthrow was expected to be quick. In 2011, it turned into a 14-year protracted, deadly war in which hundreds of thousands of people died. But that was a CIA-led operation called Operation Timber Sycamore. And Iran was the great prize. Iran is something different from all the rest. It's nearly 100 million people. It's a powerful country. Anyone who has read Herodotus, and I hope some people have, know that these issues with Iran or Persia go back thousands of years. This is a great civilization. This is not Lebanon, if I may say so, or some post-World War I construction. And so Iran was the hard case. Iran has its own long history, by the way, because Britain and the United States subverted Iran back in 1953, which was part of the long, sad saga of how the Western world has desired to wreck Iran throughout the 20th century. But having said that, they couldn't quite get to Iran until now. So this is two old, destabilized, mentally imbalanced individuals leading two militaristic states, working side by side, not one wagging the other, but both working in partnership for their respective dreams of hegemony. Bottom line, this has nothing to do with choice. This is pure imperialism of the most vulgar and dangerous kind.
Professor Sachs, thank you for that masterly discussion. Now, I have a few points of my own to make, and they're partly derived from what you said here and what you said in other places, because you've been active discussing this issue. Mm-hmm. Also, what your friend Michael Schulenberg, by the way, has been saying too. And I'd like to start briefly with something which has disturbed me greatly. Firstly, that if we talk about the attack on Iraq, in the United States, Congress was consulted. The United Nations Security Council was consulted. Of course, the United Nations Security Council, its concerns were ultimately ignored, but it was consulted. The UN Charter makes it very clear that war can only be conducted in self-defense and preferably with the authority, in fact, ultimately always with the authority of the Security Council itself, which is the institution created to preserve peace. Now, none of this has happened this time. There's been no attempt to consult Congress in the United States. There's been no attempt to consult the Security Council. The attack took place, as you say, in the midst of negotiations. The other side, Iran, was making concessions. The Imani negotiators were talking about a further meeting in Vienna. The United States itself was giving indications that it would be going to that meeting. This is cynicism taken to the most extreme level. There was no proximate threat from Iran. The president of the United States had previously said many times that the attack the United States carried out on Iran back in June had destroyed its nuclear program. Well, he might have been overstating things, but that's what he said. To me, this is not just a war of choice. That word, that expression, war of choice, makes me concerned. What this was a war of aggression.
Yes.
Or so it seems to me. And if you go back to the Nuremberg hearings, which are the foundation of modern international law, it is clearly said that wars of aggression are the worst form of crimes against peace. Crimes against peace are the supreme crime from which all other crimes come, these international war crimes come. And of course, the jurists who formulated these ideas included Joseph Jackson, who was the chief prosecutor. He was a member of the Supreme Court of the United States. He wrote a letter to President Truman, and President Truman came to the General Assembly of the United Nations and said, "We in the United States are going to be forever bound by this. We accept this. We formulated it. It applies to us to the same degree as it applies to everyone else." No one is talking about this. Where are the protests that at least we had on the eve of the conflict in Iran against Iraq? There was a small protest of perhaps a few thousand people in London. Nothing comparable to the kind of protests that took place then. Is it because we've had so many wars for all of these extraordinary... and I have to say, what you described, I mean, the ultimate strategy, the strategic purpose behind this war, the clean break idea, concepts of hegemony. I mean, not only are these grotesque and unrealistic and inhuman taken to the extreme, but they underline the extent to which this is a war of aggression. I mean, wars conducted for those kind of objectives are by definition wars of aggression. But have we become so accustomed to these wars now that we allow these things in the West to take place and we have given up to a degree that I find incredibly concerning and very dangerous? We've given up pushing back or protesting against them. Not all of us, yourself, obviously. You've been a powerful and eloquent voice, one that many, many people listen to. But I don't get the sense of energy and opposition that I once did.
I agree with every word you said, and I want to underscore one of the words I think you said is grotesque. The aims are grotesque. This is Israel with the around 10 million people wanting to assert control over hundreds of millions of people. It's the United States with around 340 million people wanting to assert control over 8.1 billion people. Nothing less than that. So these are not only wars of aggression, they are wars of blatant and brazen imperialism. We're watching very old-fashioned imperialism. They are reminiscent of the 19th century. The point was, it had been for the world, that World War II was so devastating, so horrific, and the nuclear age was so dangerous that this would not be allowed to happen again. It's not that we haven't seen wars of aggression before, and we had brazen imperialism by Europe and the United States for centuries, but the idea was that we had learned something, and the preamble of the United Nations Charter says this is to end the scourge of wars that have twice visited humanity in the 20th century. So what we are witnessing is the unlearning of what we had learned. We have no instincts in Europe or the United States, and certainly none whatsoever in Israel, which lives in the 4th century BC by many of its leaders, not or 5th century BC. I shouldn't even be so generous as 4th century BC. This is brazen imperialism, and it raises many questions, of course. But for me, it raises the question, is there still a constitutional republic in the United States? And it's a very interesting question I think a lot about, because we have the paradigmatic case of the Roman Republic becoming the Roman Empire, traditionally dated to 27 BC, when Octavian declared himself Augustus and Princeps. This was the date usually given for the end of the Roman Republic. But what's very interesting, in fact, is two things. One, the trappings of republicanism in Rome continued after what we now call the start of the Roman Empire. Because the Senate still met, they still wore their togas, they still had consuls and magistrates. And to someone living at that time, they might not have said, oh, now we're an empire. We once were a republic. This was a continuation, not an event. And secondly, 27 BC the traditional date after Augustus defeats Mark Antony and so forth and declares himself princeps, was itself a gradual process that goes back throughout the first century BC with Sulla, Pompey, the triumvirate, Julius Caesar, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, the point is the U.S. has slid into empire for sure at some point. We have the trappings of constitutional republicanism, but when it comes to foreign policy, we are not a republic. We're not governed even by the sense of law. And when the Senate was asked itself last week, do we want to have anything to do with it? They didn't say, well, under Article 1 of our Constitution, it's our job to declare war. They said, no, 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 thank you. We don't want to get involved in this. This is something for the emperor. This isn't something for us. So we're already in that mode of behavior. Of course, we've seen this for decades. The imperial presidency has been noted for decades. When did it really begin? Well, clearly it's a post-World War II phenomenon. 1947, it was a kind of clean break for us. This is when the CIA was established. That created the mechanisms for U.S. post-World War II imperialism. In January 17, precisely 1961, President Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was our most celebrated general, the supreme commander of Allied forces in World War II, and then later the president, issued a stark warning that the military-industrial complex was threatening the U.S. democracy. We used to read that as a warning about the future. I now read it as a statement of the time about the existing reality that Eisenhower was telling us we've been taken over. I think we need to reread that. Arguably, just like you could date the decisive turn of Rome in 44 BC with the murder of Julius Caesar, arguably you could say that the American Empire came into full force on November 22nd, 1963, with the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which I think overwhelmingly likely was a CIA operation and was empirically the last time that a president stood up to the military-industrial state. So it is, in my view, not shocking that we see these wars of choice. They've been true all through my career. The brazenness of this is something different, as you note. There's not even an attempt at an excuse. There's not even an attempt at any kind of process. The American people are completely against this. Why is this? Two reasons. One, we have slid into imperial behavior over decades, and so all of the real institutions of control were long ago pushed aside. But second is the particular personality of Donald Trump, a dark triad personality of megalomania, malignant narcissism, and psychopathy. This is something different. You should not have a person like this as president. This is especially of such a powerful country. This is extremely dangerous. So we have this mix, but the underlying reasons is the erosion of the most basic constitutional checks. After all, I have to point out from a juridical point of view, the UN Charter is not only something that the US subscribes to, it is the law of the land. It is a treaty duly ratified by the United States Senate in July 1945, which under our Constitution makes it the law of the land. But we hear little of the Constitution. The Supreme Court, thank God, rallied a few weeks ago and said Trump can't set the whole trade regime. That's unconstitutional. That was a glimmer of light. But when it comes to foreign policy, sadly, those same nine justices would like, I don't want to put words in their mouth, God forbid, but would likely side with the imperial presidency. Why does Europe have not a word about this? Well, this is what we've been asking for years. How did Europe become a complete vassal of the United States, which it is? It is a little hard to understand. Partly it's the selection of the leaders, which have to go through the U.S. approval mill, or they get pushed aside easily. Partly it is simple mechanics. If you have U.S. military bases on your soil, you are an occupied country, whether you like it or not. You have the CIA there. You have subversion. You have U.S. direct political interference. You are a semi-occupied country. But I have to just tell you how shocking it is to hear this. I was at the UN Security Council last week. I had been invited to testify about the war, and then the UK and the US blocked me from testifying. This is par for the course. That's the least of it. But as I listened, of all people, the Danish ambassador launched in to a tirade against Iran on the day that the U.S. and Israel attacked Iran. She couldn't mention that Iran had been bombed or that 150 schoolgirls had been murdered or that this was a violation of the U.N. Charter, an unprovoked attack by Israel and the United States. She didn't even mention that. She just went into a tirade against Iran. This is the one that someday will turn to the UN and say, how can you not help us with Greenland after the United States has invaded her country? I went up to her afterwards to have a word. I wanted to point out that this is not safe for Denmark. She looked up from her notes, looked at me, turned around, and walked away. I called after her, could I have a word with you? Walked away. And so this is the state of affairs in our world today. Europe is useless. We know it. We bemoan it every day. Useless. Not a voice of sanity, except for Pedro Sanchez. Let's champion him because he's been very brave. And President Connolly of Ireland, who knows about this. But for the rest of Europe, nothing right now. On this point. And so the U.S. and Europe don't uphold the learnings of World War II or the law of the international community in the U.N. Charter. We've lost the reflexes for that. And sorry to ramble on, but in 2003, many European countries, and I remember walking across the green with Dominique de Villepin, who had just spoken at the UN Security Council. France objected to the U.S.-Iraq war. Wonderful. We don't hear a voice like that in a major European country now.
No, we don't. Let's talk about Iran, because my own clear sense is that there's been very little understanding of that country. There were a lot of assumptions that this war was going to end very quickly. There's been a universal belief among Western leaders that the government is not only unpopular, but illegitimate in some way, never exactly explained, that the course of the war has come as a terrible surprise, that nobody expected that it would have dragged on in the way that it has. And you are starting to see in the media, certainly here in Britain, what you might call the worm of doubt. People are asking, is this going to go on for a long time? Is this going to turn out well? What if it doesn't? What if we've underestimated Iran? What if we've underestimated the strength of its institutions and its armed forces and its level of economic and social cohesion? Well, if they have underestimated all of those things. That really does argue again about their planning, their quality of planning being completely wrong, because, as you say, they've been thinking about doing this for years, for decades. They should have a very clear understanding of Iran, and it seems that they don't. I mean, is that also your perception? I mean, it's certainly mine, that they really don't understand Iran, perhaps because they've fallen in with these grotesque ideas of domination of the Middle East, domination of hegemony, domination of all sorts of things. And one of the things I've learned in my life is that people who lose touch with reality on one thing eventually lose touch with reality on everything. Is that what the problem is?
I have a general principle which I've tried to get instated for many, many years, which is that the United States should not be allowed to bomb any country unless more than half the U.S. population can name two cities in that country. This would end all American wars. Americans know nothing about Iran. And that includes our leadership. Of course, I'm being jocular. We should not be bombing other countries, period. But the ignorance is beyond imagining. Donald Trump, of course, knows zero about everything. Everything. The man is a complete, total ignoramus. And that is not my testimony. That is what I hear from leaders around the world that deal with him. He's simple-minded, and this is also extraordinarily concerning. No, they don't have a plan. They don't have a strategy. They are relying basically on an old CIA failed ploy, which is get the U.S. into something and then escalate as needed. So that's not a military strategy. If it could take us back again 64 years to another CIA concoction, which was the invasion of Cuba, the Bay of Pigs in April 1961. They had no plan, but Alan Dulles thought once we get people on the ground and if they get under attack, Kennedy will have to call in air cover and we will be in a full-fledged invasion of Cuba. Now, the plan is we'll escalate as needed. That's why Trump talks about now openly, well, we're going to have to put soldiers in. We're going to have to put the boots on the ground, as it's called. I don't think this is going to happen, by the way, because the United States public is so much against this, at least 3-1 against it, and it's going to go to much longer a stronger opposition very, very soon as people see how completely reckless, violent, boneheaded all of this is. But the answer to the question is they do not have a plan. Netanyahu's plan is get the U.S. involved. Those who favor this have the plan that once we're involved, we'll just escalate as necessary. The whole thing is a complete concoction and debacle. And the best evidence of that is the market judgment, because that's a kind of summary of those who are whose money is directly at stake. Today, oil prices have soared well above $100 a barrel by some quotes that I saw just in the few minutes before we started, up to about $120 a barrel. Oil is on the route to doubling in price over this very early stretch from pre-war price until today. It's not quite there yet, but it's headed there. This is an economic calamity, but the point is that those who put their money down in bets and the market bet on energy is the cleanest and clearest of this bets is that we have a disaster unfolding.
Let's talk about that, because you're perhaps the best person to discuss this. $120 a barrel oil we have already a very difficult economic situation in Europe altogether. In Germany, they've been talking about deindustrialization. In Britain, there's a strong sense of economic malaise. In every Western country, people's living standards are under very, very great stress. $120 a barrel oil. What is that going to do to the world economy now, especially if the shock continues very long? And did the people who made the proximate decisions to start this now, did they not realize that this might happen? I mean, it was so likely that it would happen. How could they miss it? But tell us, first of all, about what are the possible outcomes. And by the way, before you do, can I just point to people what a prescient economic commentator you are in some respects? I remember when Trump brought in the tariffs, you said that the tariffs would not reduce the American trade deficit. They didn't, just to say. So given that kind of exemplary track record, what are your thoughts about this?
Yeah, if I could just say on the tariffs very briefly, I said, A, they're illegal, brazenly illegal. B, they wouldn't reduce the trade deficit. Three, they wouldn't create manufacturing jobs, which on our February report are down 100,000 jobs from last year to this year. The whole thing is so incredibly imbecilic. Okay, I'll put that aside. Yeah. On this one, you know, this is weird, but my PhD dissertation 46 years ago was on oil shocks. It was doing the first modeling of the oil shocks of 1973-74 and 1979-80. I wrote the first book about the economics of worldwide stagflation, published in 1982. So I've been thinking about this for decades, actually. The fact of the matter is this is an extremely, extremely serious shock to the world economy. It is likely to be prolonged. Of course, we're in the very first days, so things can change. But it doesn't seem like the U.S. is backing down, and it does seem like the energy facilities of the Gulf region and Iran are being destroyed or heavily damaged. And one country after another is shutting in its production because you can't produce if you can't store or ship. And they can do neither right now. So we're seeing soaring oil prices. We're seeing another important indicator, the volatility of the stock market soar once again. That's called the VIX index. That is also a predictor of a serious economic crisis. So I believe we're entering into a worldwide economic crisis this year. When it happened in the 1970s, output relative to trend, in other words, taking into account that world output has an underlying upward trend, and then comparing where things were a year after the oil shock from where they were would have been expected to be, the downturns in both 73, 74, and 79, 80 were on the order of 4 or 5% of world output relative to trend. Very sizable shocks. A lot of economic pain, a lot of unemployment. I think we're heading for that right now. Of course, things can change. These are early days, but at least as of the past few days, those who really are watching in minute detail what's being blown up, what production is stopping, what the chances of the U.S. military opening the Strait of Hormuz and so forth, what they're telling us is This is a very, very serious economic crisis lying ahead. And I think that it comes in the context of a lot of weakness in the U.S. already. The jobs declined in February. They've basically been stagnant or in decline for several months. Europe is in persistent crisis in a very weak state across Europe. So I would expect that this would mean a downturn in both the United States and Europe this year. Trump being insane, actually. Oh, so oil prices will go up. So it's the price we have to bear. The voters will have a different idea very soon. This will be true across Europe. There is revulsion at the political class in Europe. There is revulsion of Trump. And we need to remember, these are the people we see strutting on the stage. They are not liked. They are not popular. They are not following public opinion whatsoever. And occasionally, rarely, but occasionally, the public gets a say in this, and the say is not going to be a happy one. Of course, all of this depends on U.S. ballots actually being counted in November, which is going to be another drama coming up.
Mm-hmm. We're just having an election, by the way, in Baden-Württemberg in Germany. And the early reports are that the CDU has lost ground significantly and might lose the state. So anyway, we'll see. Is there any way back? Is there any way out of this mess? I mean, I have to say that the idea of sending in the U.S. Navy to provide escorts to tankers. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it's a delusion on a delusion on a delusion. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so that's not going to happen.
That's not going to happen. So, I mean, what can be done? Because the other great change in the world is that the United States does not have the overwhelming monopoly over power that it did, say, 30 years ago. There are other very, very big players now. There's China, where Donald Trump is supposed to go at the end of this month. There's Russia, of course. There's India, too. There's all sorts of countries. One gets the sense that none of them are happy. What might happen? Might we actually see an international movement to end this war outside the West? That would be something very new if it were to be effective.
Yes. There will be a world rising demand to end the war as the economic pain hits. And that economic pain is going to hit quite quickly in prices, of course, for petrol and diesel and in electricity costs and in other ways. So it won't take that long for the pain to be widely felt. This is one point. That will cause politicians to scramble. What do we do? How do we survive? What do we say to our publics? The way that this war ends, and the only way, in my view, that it ends, is that the United States and Israel stop their war of aggression, period. I don't think it's going to end at the negotiating table. I don't see what the negotiations would be about. I don't see their being a possibility of negotiating right now, but there is absolutely the possibility that Israel and the United States stop the attack. Of course, that is a loss of face. Who gives a, and I won't say it, but basically who could care that Trump and Netanyahu lose face? Despicable people who went against the world good. Of course they should lose face. They're disgraceful. We need the fighting to stop. It could stop if there is a crescendo of voices for it to stop. That crescendo will not start in Europe because they don't even have a voice that they know how to utilize right now. But that even that will come later. the voices have to start with where you absolutely indicated, and that is with the BRICS countries. China and Russia, of course, are allies of Iran. They're supporting Iran. The idea that, oh, they're giving intelligence, are you kidding? Why not? This is also a U.S. war directed against Russia and China, have no doubt about it. This is world hegemony at stake. Of course, they are going to give material support, financial support, military support, probably not direct troops, but a lot of other kinds of support. Of course, that's going to happen. But diplomatically, what I find most interesting is India. India, to my mind, is actually the decisive factor in this right now. Sad to say, India plays two roles, one of them completely erroneous for India, and the other very important. The erroneous role is India thinking that it will replace China as America's supplier, and that it will reap benefits together with the United States and Israel with the United States against China and Israel as a provider of military technology and intelligence technology. So India has sidled up to the United States despite all the abuses, and it hasn't really ended that. Modi was in Israel a few days ago. For God's sake, what the heck is that? And there's also, well, there's other considerations, but that's one side. The other side is India should remember that its colonization by the British Empire wasn't a great party. It was a disaster. And the same with the United States, to become a vassal of the United States, to play with the United States in the Quad, to suffer a calamitous energy crisis because India is completely energy import dependent from the Middle East because of a U.S.-Israeli war of imperialism is not what India wants. So India has the presidency of the BRICS this year. If India, Russia, China, Brazil, South Africa, the African Union, Egypt, Ethiopia, all stand up and say, this is outrageous. And if Europe, God help us, would follow Pedro Sanchez and say, this is not good for us. Actually, the fighting will stop. After that, I think the consequences will be extremely significant. Of course, the U.S. will have been exposed as exactly Kissinger's adage has it, to be a friend of the United States is fatal. This will be proved yet again. I don't think Israel can continue in this mad, violent way after this. It will have created a worldwide crisis, not just a regional crisis. I think Israel, if it continues in this way, should be expelled or suspended from the UN as South Africa was. It is a violent, vicious state that either regains its senses or is going to lose its hold. So this is going to be another reckoning that will come. But I think the way this war will end is the world telling the United States and Israel, stop, it's over. You're wrecking the whole world.
Professor Sachs, thank you very much. That is all I wanted to ask you. And I want to say thank you again for your extremely helpful, comprehensive, thorough, insightful answers.
I'm going to have to run right now. To run. So okay. Terrific to be with you. We'll see you soon.
Thank you, Professor Sachs.
Thank you.
All right, Alexander, you there?
Yes, absolutely, very much so.
Cool. Okay, great discussion.
Always with Professor Sachs, always an extraordinary discussion. I've read his book, by the way, the 1982 book that he wrote on oil prices, on oil shocks. I read it many years ago. Well, it is not there in the library. I will try and get myself another copy, just to say. I think it bears rereading.
Yeah. Well, we have some breaking news, kind of breaking news, that Bahrain's state oil company has declared force majeure on shipments.
It's the first one. Well, I think Qatar
their oil refinery was smashed yesterday, I believe, or this morning. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. So force majeure. That's going to be one of many, I believe.
Yes. No? Oh, they will all follow. The Saudis will be the last, but all the others will start tumbling one after the other, probably this week.
Trump tells us not to worry, though. It's all going to come down.
No cause for concern. Everything is going exactly according to plan.
Trust the plan. Just trust the plan. Absolutely. All right. Let's begin. One second with Elza. How's the situation for Starmer in the UK? Trump and Blair are angry with Britain, but the Iran conflict seems to have made the Epstein problem go away, at least at the moment. Thanks.
One says this, but the British public still seem to be very, very angry with Keir Starmer. I suspect they're getting angrier, actually. And the latest opinion poll suggests that in the local elections in London in May, Labour is going to be driven to fourth place. Now, London has always been a Labour stronghold since the 1930s. For Labour to be pushed into fourth place in London would be absolutely existential territory. I mean, it would be, it's extinction territory for the Labour Party.
From Russell Hall, that moment when you realize the entire strategy for starting World War III was taken from an old episode of South Park. They're coming right for us.
You know, Pete Hegseth actually looks like he's walked straight out of that South Park cartoon. I mean, that's all I could say about him.
Yeah. Commando Crossfire says, if I could tell the world just one thing, it would be that we're all okay and not to worry, because worry is wasteful and useless in times like these.
That is a very, very wise counsel. Yeah.
Commando Crossfire says, I won't be made useless. I won't be idle with despair. I'll gather myself around my faith, for light's the darkness most fear.
Very good.
Haruko, thank you for that super sticker. Elza says, Mr. Sachs, you said that you wouldn't vote for Trump because he wasn't a president of peace. Even though, have you still been disappointed? Have you persevered your idealism and optimism?
Well, I think Professor Sachs feels vindicated. He never had thought very much of Donald Trump, and I'm afraid he's turned out to be completely right.
No, Banga says, is it possible war in Ukraine won't end because the West is accumulating immense training data for future wars using AI? It could be a data harvest.
Well, it will end, and it will end, I think, much sooner now than it would otherwise have done. Perhaps even this year, actually, because without the military and technological and intelligence assistance of the United States, the war cannot go on and wouldn't have gone on anyway for as long as it has done. Now that is all been withdrawn, and as Alex pointed out, they're all panicking. The Europeans are now getting scared about this because and you can read about this, I think, was it Axios?
Politico had an article.
Politico, yeah, exactly.
They bought the weapons, but now they're afraid. They paid for the weapons, they say, but now they're afraid they're not going to get them.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
I guess they can ask for their money back from
Trump.
Trump will give them their money back.
Of course he will. Absolutely, yes. With interest.
Yes, of course. Jeffrey Silver says, great to catch you all live during these troubling times. Addie Petrao gifted the Durad 5 memberships. Thank you for that. Valerie of Russia says, what's the best way to contact you two directly? Locals? I hear Alexander often talking about emailing with viewers, but no details.
Yes, you can write to us at editor@theDuran, and we will respond.
Or Telegram. You can also
Telegram. Telegram is another good place, actually. Yeah.
Last C3D says 2 seconds before World War III, Jeffrey Sachs still wanted a two-state solution. He probably still wants it. That fake promised two-state solution is part of why we're in World War III now. Get your bedroom ready for your cousins.
Well, the two-state solution was proposed back in 1967, directly after the Six-Day War, UN Security Council Resolution 242. It has, of course, never been implemented. We've never moved forward with anything remotely like its implementation. It has been systematically sabotaged ever since. I think back in 1967, it might have formed a way towards some kind of long-term peace agreement. Even someone like Sergei Lavrov, who has been one of the strongest advocates of it, is now, by his own admission, starting to have doubts. That he's recently said that given the realities on the ground now, it might not be capable of being implemented at all. And that, by the way, is a terrible thing. Because without it, what is the plan? What is the way forward? How can you construct a consensus in the Middle East towards peace?
Valerie of Russia says, I would love a video revisiting the Russian Olympic doping scandal. I'm still not sure what happened there. Has your assessment changed from 7 years ago?
No, it hasn't changed at all. You sound like you might have read some of the things that we were writing about it 7 years ago, because I remember writing extensively about it on our website at the Duran, and the articles that I wrote then are still there. But no, yes, let us indeed revisit it, because it looks as if Russia is now being readmitted into the Olympic movement. So this is perhaps a good moment to do it.
Dionysia says, how should we view the claim that Iran is a sponsor of terrorism?
Well, the first thing, this is what I would say about this. First of all, there is no Middle East country, none at all, that hasn't dabbled in terrorism to a greater or lesser degree. So to say that Iran has never engaged in terrorism whatsoever or involved itself in it, I think would be wrong. To say that it has by itself, given the region, doesn't tell you very much. Where I would push back strongly is against the claim that many people, including Donald Trump, make, which is that Iran is the biggest and most important sponsor of terrorism in the Middle East, or indeed anywhere. And I have to say that simply doesn't seem to me to accord with the facts at all. In terms of terrorism, Iran has been much more often the victim than the perpetrator.
From Flipper Zero, Trump is pure id for sure, but what if he launched this war so that the deep state doesn't facilitate his overthrow after the midterms? It seems like a weird endeavor to undertake purely on his own volition.
Well, if that is his thinking, then I have to say this. He's not an adequate or proper person to be president of the United States. If he is so worried that he's going to be overthrown in November that he launches a war, then he's got to ask himself, is he putting his own private interests over the wider public interest and that of the United States? Surely, anyway, the better thing to do in response to that possibility that he might be challenged in that kind of way, is to go out into the country, as he used to do, talk to his supporters, as he used to do, meet them, explain to them what the risks are, and try to win them round and to get them to support him in the face of the crisis that is to come. Trump has retreated into this bunker in the Oval Office and the White House, and he's completely lost touch with the sentiments of his base and indeed with reality altogether.
Valerie of Russia says, also, I would love some videos discussing orthodoxy, both in terms of your individual beliefs, but also in regards to nefarious political meddling.
We have plans to do precisely that. Alex has been in discussion with a particular individual who would assist us greatly in having precisely those sort of discussions.
Sampras 1268 says, China is not as strong as the Soviet Union was in protecting deterrence versus the USA. They need to step in or else they will be isolated with Russia. The Americans will not stop.
China is not the Soviet Union, and it has repeatedly said that it does not intend to mimic the policies of the Soviet Union. It looks as also what the Soviet Union, what became of the Soviet Union. It says to itself, we don't want to be there. China's primarily about its own economic and social development, in which it has been extraordinarily successful. It is unrealistic to expect China to play the same kind of role in world affairs that the Soviet Union did, which, remember, was a European country caught up in a Cold War with the West, which was ultimately a conflict about Europe, just to say. So, you know, one shouldn't have expectations that cannot be realized.
Upandek says, greetings from Northeast India. I'm a doctor by profession, and my day always ends with Alexander's videos. Also a great fan of Mr. Sachs, and to be able to hear his masterful words is such an honor.
Thank you very much for those very kind words.
Francis 74, thank you for that super chat. Johan 83 says, Alex, Alexander, Jeffrey, thank you for all the work you do. Hopefully the Wi-Fi works when I check into the bush so I can keep listening to you guys for some sanity.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Ralph Steiner says, as a ruling god king or even a demigod, a modern day Achilles, will Trump lead his American Christian soldiers to victory over the Muslim infidels?
Well, they won't. These are dangerous thoughts. And to repeat again, we had somebody talk about orthodoxy. I mean, orthodoxy is very, very mistrustful of, you know, demigods, heroes amongst human beings. It says, you know, we're all human beings and we need to accept those conditions. We should never aspire to be more than human beings, because if we do, we cease to be human. We cease being human beings. We become something else, and that is a terrible thing.
Blank Blank says, almost at the timeline of BB's son Bobo leading. James Bondish says, 70 years, born 1956, old school dropout, born in New England, and have so much respect for Professor Sachs and the Duran for telling the truth.
Thank you
for that. Magnolia Vulcan says, this will drag into a multi-year quagmire.
I'm afraid it will.
Eccles Bourne says, hi, Duran. What was the shortest functioning empire?
What was the shortest functioning? Yeah, that's a very good question. I'm not sure. I'd have to go through history to find out.
Stefan G61 says, great to see Mr. Sachs back. Ralph Steiner says, beware of when fighting monsters. You yourself do not become a monster, for when you gaze long into the abyss gazes also into you, Nietzsche.
Absolutely true.
Lisa 5156 says, Trump speaks as if he's divinely chosen to save the world. It sounds crazier every day. Is there a mechanism for Americans to remove him from office?
Well, there is this impeachment. There's the 25th Amendment. These are matters for the Americans themselves to think about and decide what they're going to do about. I will say this. After the assassination attempt, the one that did damage to him, the one that he escaped very, very narrowly, I've always felt and I've always been worried that he was indeed developing some kind of idea, people in that kind of situation do, that they've been chosen in some way, preserved in some way to do some great thing. And that is I find that a rather dangerous thing altogether. And it worries me that this has completely consumed him now and is leading us to this disaster that we're seeing today.
Jungle Jin says, Zionist control of the U.S. and its imperialism reminds one of the kind of cordyceps fungal infection of insects that create zombie hosts.
Oh, well.
Nick Maslovich, thank you for that super sticker. The man right Chi says, it will all stop if Israel lays down their arms.
Well, they're not going to lay down their arms. I mean, we shouldn't, if we're going to look for somewhere where it will stop, where the decision to stop it must be made, it must be made in Washington.
Ralph Steiner says, is Oceania now at war with Eurasia? Oceania, tis for thee, deed, every thought, tis for thee. 1984 was indeed a prophetic book.
It was in many ways, not just that one.
Zabinator says, wonder how many U.S. soldiers died for Israel today.
Who knows? I've seen many reports say that the number that they're giving, which is 9, is wrong. I am not going to second guess behind this. I find this a difficult and impossible and disturbing thing to do.
Sam Press says, what do the right-wing populists say about Iran, about the Iran war, Le Pen, Orban, Farage? Exactly, this is why I miss the old left in Europe. These populist right want hegemony. This is why I don't trust them. Don't talk about the liberals.
Well, as an old leftist, as somebody who used to be part of that, I understand completely what you mean. One of the reasons we don't have a great organized anti-war movement resisting this at this moment is precisely because that old left, of which historically, once upon a time, long ago, I used to be a part, no longer exists anymore.
Muzzle Flash says, what happened to the climate change cult?
Well, the Greens apparently have won in Bath and Veldenburg. Don't underestimate them.
Ralph Steiner says, in the book 1984, why did George Orwell omit the obvious evangelical Christian Zionist apocalyptic vision that is accompanying the real turn of events?
Because he had many, many other very important things to discuss. And that was not the most important one in that book. I mean, the book couldn't cover everything.
MCH Parody, thank you for that super sticker. Hafaz says, Iran must charge a toll for Hormuz.
Well,
Edward Bernays says, is the only way for the global south to end this terrible war against Iran to abandon reliance on the petrodollar?
Well, yes. And by the way, I think Professor Sachs's comments about India are well said. This is a catastrophe for India. I mean, the country that is going to be one of the countries that's going to be most exposed by $120 oil is going to be India. And India's voice has been silent. They should be loudly calling for an end to the war.
Well, Modi went to Israel to get on board with the war.
Well, indeed, absolutely. He thought it would. Oh. He was another one of these people who thought it would be easy.
And he
remained silent when the warship was sunk after attending a military exercise in India. In other words, coming to India at India's invitation. There's been much criticism of this. If he isn't careful, his entire political position in India could unravel. And the people who are vote for him in their tens of millions, if they see their oil, the oil price, the energy costs, which are for them an existential issue, surge in the way that they are, they could turn on him, and they would be right to.
Ralph Steiner says there's strong movement to have Barron Trump included in any American military draft for boots on the ground in Iran. Could Prince Harry join too?
Well, of course. I mean, with those two, how can we lose?
Yeah. Nico says, for the first time since 1 year of Trump, President Putin has condemned the entire West for both Iran and Ukraine. He returned back to his Biden language. Then Peskov came out and said that international law doesn't apply anymore. And as Putin said, they should focus on themselves. Negotiations are over.
I think you're right. I mean, I'm not fully up to date yet with Putin's latest words, but I think this has been a drift of discussion that really began in Russia, not as a result of the Valdai attack, even before. We talked about this. We talked about how Putin was going increasingly out of, on a limb by persisting on, in the negotiations. Then the Valdai attack came, and that was an enormous moment. But now we've had this.
Sorry, go ahead. I just said the Valdai attack, how crazy that was.
Well, absolutely. Yeah. Well, it tells you exactly. I mean, it's the same. So it's the same people making the same kind of decisions, trying to do the same things, or again and again and again. I think this is a moment. This is the moment when even Putin says enough.
Uzer76 says, "What do you think Putin will do if the war continues for a while? Will he just limit the assistance with the intel and weapons, or will he do more? What if the U.S. is successful in Iran?"
Well, if the U.S. is successful in Iran, that will be a major problem for Russia and the BRICS, but it will also be a very, very major problem for the United States, because it would then have a broken Iran. And as I think it was Colin Powell said to George W. Bush about Iraq, you broke it, you own it. We will have chaos in the Middle East. The chaos will be even greater. And the Russians being in the region probably would be in a better position long term to get a handle over it than the United States would be. But of course, it would be a problem. They will do, if the war drags on, the Russians will gradually step up aid.
Has Trump defined what a win is? I mean, he hasn't even defined any. Has he defined the objectives? No. Has he defined why they're even in this war? Nothing.
Well, there was an article yesterday in The Intercept. And of course, it is The Intercept. So, you know, be careful. They don't like Trump. And they do all sorts of things. But they say that all sorts of people have been coming and speaking to them and have been telling that this is people from within the administration. And they said that they cannot discern any kind of strategy or plan at all. It's all been made up from one day to the next. And I have to say, to me, for the moment, that's how it looks.
That's how it looks, yeah. Mike Flyer says, "Thank you, gentlemen of the Duran Sanity in Chaos." Mm. Ralph Steiner says, "Have you heard that Trump is building the ballroom?" Nico says, "Iran is handling the media optics very well. The hatred towards the expats from the younger generation is insane after they showed them dancing."
Yeah.
Nico says, "Khamenei's son is now the new supreme leader. Seems people like it. Also, Pezeshkian is doing what he does best, treating the injured. He was a doctor."
Yes, he was. Absolutely. And I mean, you know, they are doing these things. Now, as I said, we've replaced one Khamenei with another more hardline Khamenei, who is very, very angry because his father, his mother,
his daughter and son,
I believe, have all been killed.
Yeah. Taliban for Taliban, Khamenei for Khamenei. Yeah.
Exactly.
Matthew says Trump will soon declare victory, and that's that.
Well, he might do, but he won't be able to get away with it this time.
Nico says, "I spoke too soon about the ships. Sweden seized another ship. People demanding that Putin do what the U.S. does to Europe. They are blockading Russia."
Well, then, no. This has been happening for a while. All in the middle of an energy crisis. As I said, the Russians will deal with it.
They won't do anything, you said.
Well, the Russians will deal with it.
Ah, deal with it. Oh,
we'll deal with it. They will create their convoys. Yeah. They will do all of these things. But bear in mind, with exploding energy prices, this policy of blockading ships, trying to interfere even further with the oil, is unsustainable.
Yeah. CSJ001 says, "India's position as growing economy is different to all others. China, US, UK have all supported Pakistan apart from Israel. They forgot the pressure we withstood for Russia. And now with one meeting, we are a vassal state."
Well, I understand all of this. But again, I think that on this particular issue that we're talking about now, India has not been has not been wise. I'm not suggesting India is a vassal state. I'm saying that India has made mistakes in its handling of this particular affair. Yeah. India should have been a strong advocate before the war of the negotiations. And it should be leading the calls now for an end to the fighting and ultimately for a return to negotiations.
And Modi should have issued some sort of statement about the ship.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Zariel says, Empire of China, 1915-16 by Yaren Shikai. You're welcome. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Zariel. Uzar76 says, do you think that Russia is going this slow in Ukraine because of Putin? This war is about diplomacy and not territory, that ultimately he gets an agreement with the U.S., or will he just take Ukraine?
Well, Stanislav Krapivnik, whom we've spoken to many times, says that the sentiment in the military is that they would like to move faster, and they've been held back by restraints from the political leadership in Moscow. And I think that there's been, certainly up to now, a sense in Moscow that taking this thing reasonably slow actually worked overall to Russia's diplomatic advantage. It kept the other BRIC states happy, and it did perhaps provide for a possibility of some sort of long-term agreement with the United States. I think as of now, none of that applies any longer. So we might start to see things move more quickly. But I'm also going to say something about the way in which the war has been conducted. I think it also reflects the style of the Russian general staff, which is running this war, which tends to be very systematic and very long-term, looking for a complete and decisive long-term permanent victory.
Nico says, it's not just the ship seizures that need to stop. The Russian air defense in the south is depleted. Belgorod and Krasnodar can't take any more.
I think that is a huge overstatement. I've not seen anybody suggest this. Well, maybe one or two bloggers have done. But overall, and I get to repeat what I've said, the drone attacks that the Ukrainians have conducted have had only a peripheral, a minimal impact on Russia itself.
The hockey goalie says, is Iran's willingness to directly strike U.S. and Gulf putting pressure on Putin to be more directed in Ukraine, a weaker nation calling the West's bluff?
Well, I think there is some element of this. I mean, Lavrov gave a very interesting summary in which he was saying that, yes, there's been an awful lot of opposition to the whole diplomatic dialogue with the Americans. He finally admitted that there have been many people in Russia who have been very, very critical of this process. And he spoke about it rather defensively. And he said, look, we did come to an agreement with the Americans in Anchorage, and we're going to stick by that. The Americans so far have not been, but we're not making any concessions beyond it. And that the good feelings that had briefly existed in Anchorage have completely dissipated. Now, he'd clearly been in discussion with Putin, but it was very carefully worded language. But it was constructed, I think, to signal that we tried it, we went as far as we could. This is where basically it ends.
Nico says the main problem with the West is unprecedented arrogance, and it's showcased in the media. How dare they lecture Russia and Iran about civilians?
Arrogance is off the scale. You're completely right about that.
Leo Gong, thank you for that super sticker. Monty says, what with the left in Britain and politics in general beyond the protest vote for the Greens? I can't imagine people being very impressed with the Greens beyond the wheel.
Well, I think myself that if the Greens ever get hold of the wheel, they will lose support very quickly. Because to be frank, I think their program, if one could call it that, is a fantastic one, just to say.
Geo Stone says, history is being made of China being a superpower. Joker84D says, the U.S. needs a new party, hard anti-imperial, anti-Zionist, domestic-focused, anti-war. There's good people on the left and right. It's about corrupt elites and globalists and the people, not the left and the right.
Trying to create such a party in the U.S. is almost impossible, in my experience. I've seen the attempts made many, many times, and they never quite succeed. Besides, you have the libertarians. They're already saying many of these things.
Yeah. Nico says, as an aspiring nuclear physicist, I must talk about the environmental contamination. Acid rain is falling in Tehran. Satellites show Bushehr is damaged.
Yes.
Sam Perse says, Russia will not just take the whole of Ukraine. When Ukraine really runs out of money, weapons, then Ukraine will come to the table and Russia will get the four regions and parts of Kharkov and Sumy. Very clear to me.
Well, quite possibly.
Uzer says, what is your opinion, the worst case scenario that could happen with the U.S.-Israel-Iran war, and the best case?
The worst case scenario is that we have a kind of collapse in Iran and enormous waves of chaos across the Middle East and enormous refugee flows in Europe and a spread of violence across the Middle East. And I mean, that would be an appalling disaster. The optimal outcome, which isn't going to happen, is that there is a cessation of hostilities. I think that's a better word, by the way, than a ceasefire. A cessation of hostilities. It means finally the idea of war taken off the table and a return to long-term constructive negotiations. But that's not going to happen.
Nuclear war is also a very...
Well, that is, maybe that's true. I mean, nuclear war cannot be ruled out in this. I think of all of the various conflicts that have been fought since Vietnam, when there was serious thought given to using nuclear weapons, by the way, this is the one that possibility is closest.
Ralph Steiner says, Trump's closest advisor and the leader of the USA, Bibi Netanyahu, would like to deal with Turkey as well in this conflict. Will this be a problem?
We talked about this with Professor Sachs. I mean, grotesque ambitions. I mean, you go after Iran, you then go after Turkey as well. I mean, this isn't folly. It's outright madness.
Mike, who at the UN is even considering Israel suspension or expulsion, as Professor Sachs suggests. Hegseth does look like a South Park character.
Yes. Well, so far, nobody is. But then the effect of this crisis is going to change the politics of the Middle East. The one of the reasons why pressure of that kind on to suspend Israel, for example, has never been there, is because the Arab Gulf states have always opposed it. Now, of course, they are in crisis. If the crisis continues, they're going to start to lose their diplomatic traction anyway.
Uzer76 says, thank you. Always a pleasure to listen to you. Thank you for that. Salim Mulia says, what's next for Palestine?
Well, I'm afraid a continuation and a prolongation of the existing crisis, which has been a crisis ever since I can remember. Of course, if this war develops in a particular way, then, of course, that might lead to openings which could be used to improve the situation. But we are very far from that point now.
Little Falker 187 says, what would the U.S. do if China decided now is a good time to take Taiwan?
Well, what indeed? I think the US has no plan for that, by the way.
Does China have a plan for that?
Well, that's a good question. I don't think they do, as it happens.
Nikki Ball says, can nuclear facilities at Dimona be destroyed or incapacitated without causing nuclear fallout?
I don't know. I don't know what the design of Dimona is like, what the fail safes there are. I am not able to answer those questions. And I doubt that many people can, by the way. I mean, I don't know to what extent Dimona has been hardened. My guess, and it's purely a guess, is not very much, because I don't think Israel or the United States have ever given any forethought, ever contemplated this possibility.
Josie Real says, Julius Caesar and Octavian Augustus had popular support from the people, unlike Trump.
Indeed, they did. Very, very much so. And by the way, going back to some of the things that Professor Sachs was saying about the transition in Rome from republic to empire, just to demonstrate the cynicism of the time. Of course, what Caesar Augustus always said he was doing was restoring the republic. That was his program.
All right.
There's all a very right, good I'll... book about all of this, by the way, just to quickly say, by a man called Ronald Syme, written before the Second World War, called The Roman Revolution. If you want to read about the whole history here and how it happened, it's probably still the best place.
All right. We will end the live stream there. Thank you to Professor Sachs for joining us. Thank you to everyone that watched us on this live stream. And thank you to our moderators. Take care, everybody.